And thanks again to everybody that's read, that's helped us open the meeting and take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Particular welcome to any visitors to our meeting, and a huge welcome to anyone that's new to NA and our meetings tonight. And we hope that you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. I'm delighted to say our speaker has arrived, and it falls to me to introduce them. And I met this gentleman online in the last few months. We have a kind of a few common friends. He's over in the US, and I'm just really amazed and incredibly grateful for his commitment to these kinds of meetings, and what he's been doing in the last 6 months has been just awesome. He's got a bit of clean time behind him, and I'm going to leave him to share that with you. But it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce you to Tim. So Tim is going to share for us for up to 40, 45 minutes his experience, strength and hope. So, Tim, over to you, my friend. The floor is yours. Please share with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
I believe
yes,
so.
Indeed.
Nice and clear.
Yes, we can. Loud and clear.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Steve, thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's been wonderful. You've been quite a bright spot in my recovery recently. Everybody, actually, who I've met in this process has really enhanced my recovery recently. I'm an addict named Tim. I should always start with that.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome.
Thank you so much. My clean date is 12, I'll say it in the UK way. My clean date is 16-12-98. My sponsor is Mike D. My home group physically is the Here and Now group of Sun City area in lovely and scenic Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. My cyber home group is the Stroud Soldiers, located in Stroud in the UK. And I'm clean today through the grace and mercy of the God of my understanding and the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. What a miracle that has transpired in my life over the last few decades. And I'm forever grateful for this process. And I want to thank Steve in particular for inviting me out to share my experience, strength, and hope with everyone, because we can only keep what we have by giving it away. And I appreciate Steve allowing me to participate in my recovery today. I got clean outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, back in 98. I've had a few sponsors over the years. Mike wasn't, of course, isn't my original sponsor, but yeah, I was very blessed to get clean where I got clean, because Bucks County, Pennsylvania, for those of you who may know a little history of NA, was one of the places in the country that had a lot to do with the writing of the basic text. My former sponsor, George R., was very instrumental in chairing two of the committees that wrote chapters 8 and 10 of the basic text. And I only share that to say that the area that I got clean in was rich in Narcotics Anonymous history, even in 1998. It wasn't, it wasn't a new area even then, you know, and I'm truly blessed been able to have gotten clean there, because when I reached the end of my road in active addiction, there was already two meetings a day. You had a choice at night of two meetings a night back in 1998 in Bucks County, which was, so I was spoiled right from Jump Street. I didn't have to travel hours and miles to get to a meeting. Well, sometimes miles, but never hours, to make 7 NA meetings a week. So I was truly blessed that I had this fellowship at my fingertips right from the beginning. And I'm forever grateful for that, and it's funny, but you take that kind of stuff for granted when you first get clean, because, it's there, you're just used to it. And then we would travel to other areas and other places, just even to places like a few hundred miles west of us in the United States. And you'd run into these areas where you literally had to drive hundreds of miles to make an NA meeting every day of the week. So, circumstances can dictate how smooth or how hard you have to work for your recovery in the beginning. I was blessed that meetings, at least my meeting attendance, was simplified in the beginning. The step process, not so much. Luckily, I was willing when I got here because I used drugs for 31 years. I was in active addiction for 31 years. I picked up, I don't do a big drug-a-log, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, of course, I haven't spoken for 40 minutes in a while, so I may touch on a couple here and there, but for the most part, you know, it was, alcohol was my first drug of choice, and crack cocaine kicked my ass at the end. You can fill in the blanks in between, you know, whether you want to talk about, you know, marijuana or LSD or methamphetamine or whatever. You know, I'm not gonna go into, you know, the exact nature of the drug, but I will gonna tell you that each and every one of them participated in my ultimate downfall and my ultimate surrender to Narcotics Anonymous. So in a bizarre sort of way, I'm grateful to each and every one of them for making my life that much more difficult and unmanageable, so that ultimately I would surrender to the blessing of Narcotics Anonymous. But that path, you know, we talk about our message, right? The message of NA is that an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. A message of hope and a promise of freedom, right? That promise has been fulfilled in my life, you know, with all the times in my life, I have not had the obsession to use for a very, very long time. And that's not that I haven't thought about using, but I don't have that obsession, you know, and that's a gift of the God of my understanding and the fellowship. But, you know, our message is a three-part one, right? We can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use. So those are the first two parts. The tough part is the last part, right? Find a new way to live. Because many of us, myself included, I got clean in the same home. I got clean in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. I did some outpatient treatment, but I never went inpatient to a facility. I got clean in the same house that I lived in the same neighborhood that I lived in the same neighborhood that my drug dealers lived in. So I never did a geographical, moved out of the area to get clean. I got clean right where I lived. So finding that new way to live within the same environment in which I used them was interesting. You know, luckily, when I surrendered, I surrendered. I mean, it's really the only way I can say it. But the reason I brought up the three-part story of our message is that fact my active addiction was a three-part story, because I fell in love with drugs. The first part of it was a love story, right? I fell in love with drugs. I fell in love with the way they made me feel. Like my whole life, I felt uncomfortable in my own skin. Like I mentioned, the liquid drug being my first drug of choice. Like I can remember as a young child, at my family gatherings, I would see the adults standing around this little mini bar that my Uncle Jerry had in the house. And they would all be, back then they were called highballs, you know, sevens and sevens. And I would watch all the adults standing around there laughing and socializing. And then the women would go into another room and congregate, and Uncle Jerry would deliver drinks to the ladies. And then the men would stand around talking men stuff and drinking. And it was like, I can just remember as a child looking up and going, wow, I can't wait till I grow up enough to be that, to be able to do that. It was so attractive to me. And I can remember being like walking into at a funeral, one of the family gatherings, and we did the after the funeral, we did the brunch, you know, the family brunch and like a reception kind of thing. And it was in a catered place. And I would walk by this room where that was all chrome and wood and with glasses hanging off of these things. And it was just like so enticing to me. So I only share that with you because these are things like, right, I was drawn to the atmosphere of that. That whole scenario just always called out to me. Maybe it's my Irish heritage, who knows? But, you know, it was just like always attractive. So I think I had the predisposition right from Jump Street. I'm not a doctor, and I don't know whether this disease is generic or genetic or a family disease. I don't know. Because as it turned out, 55 years later, I found out that I was adopted. So I don't even know my birth parents. I found out when I was 62 years old that I had been adopted. So I don't know what my genetic predisposition was. All I know is that that kind of lifestyle was always attractive to me. So that love story began at the age of 12 when I picked up my first drink on my way to a Halloween party, because I was painfully shy around women, and I was just shy, painfully so around women though. And when I had that first drink, all of a sudden I was this different person. I had courage. I could talk to girls. I could stand up for myself. I could do all those things that I was never able to do. And that really, it's like, wow, So it was very cool, man. It was a party, right? It was a social event. It was a good time. A good time was had by all, right? For a while, anyway. It was a big part of my life. I would get together with my friends, and we would drink. And then all of a sudden it became the second part of that story after many, many years, of course, but nonetheless, it became a war story. Like I started noticing that my social groups started changing. The people that I started drinking with weren't drinking as much as I used to. So I had moved on to a different group of people who used like me. And that became a pattern in my life. Because now I was no longer just drinking. I was doing all the other things. And because on my 18th birthday, I was turned on to methamphetamine. And that sent me off to the races for many, many years. So I started hanging around with people who drank and did that. So my social group changed just because my drug choice had changed. And then I started using drugs a little harder than some of the people I was hanging around with. So I changed groups within that social strata. And that became a pattern of living. And finally, after a while, cocaine came into my life. Again, things changed. So it was still just a war story in the sense that it was the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. But at the end, when I finally got all the way to the end of that story, the unmanageability that comes with it, the job losses and the lost friendships and the crushed relationships, when I finally got to the end where it became a horror story, at the end, it was just me, my drug and my disease. I was using all alone. It was no longer a party. It was me and crack cocaine, and I was alone in my room with the rituals that we create and the scenarios that we create so that we can use, all the justifications and rationalizations that go along with that part of our lives, where we can make sense of what we're doing, the outdated belief systems, our defects of character, as I've come to understand through doing the step work. It was a painful place to be. I mean, I just hated myself. And I had hated myself for years. It wasn't like that horror story began like 1 year and then a year later I was clean. I mean, that horror story, after 31 years of active addiction, I mean, there was probably the last 7 or 10 years of that active addiction that I was in that horror story. I really wasn't using socially. I was copping and running. I remember that last day, that last weekend I used, I was at the bowling alley with friends over here in the U.S. I would bowl on Fridays and Mondays. And I picked up my drug of choice and I was walking out of the bar. And my friends all said, "Hey, man, we want some of that. We want some of that." And I said, "Oh, yeah, call me, yeah." And I got home and I took the phone off the hook, first thing. See, because at the end I wasn't sharing. It was mine. Once I had it in my hands, I was doing it all. I wasn't sharing it with you. I might share yours, but I wouldn't share mine. And I got home that weekend, and I went through my ritual. And on Monday morning, that was Friday, the weekend of December 11th, 1998. And I got up on Monday morning, which was the 14th of December, which is not my clean date. and I made that infamous phone call. Hey, I'm not coming into work. I'm sick, right? And I want to share this with you. Like, over the course of 31 years of active addiction, I hit a lot of bottoms. But every bottom had a basement. You know, every period of abstinence, I would hit that bottom and have a period of abstinence, and I would come up with a better idea. I would have another bright idea in my head. Well, if I stop hanging around with those people, I'll be okay. If I stop doing that drug, I'll be okay. If I stop hanging out in that place of, you know, people, places, and things. But that day, I was out of bright ideas. I made that phone call. Hey, I'm not coming into work. I'm sick. And I turned from the phone, and I had a moment of clarity, an epiphany, whatever phraseology you want to use, whatever makes you comfortable. All I know is I saw the futility of my life pass before my eyes. Both my parents were still living at that point. And I knew that I could see myself on a downward spiral again. I still had stuff. I still had a roof over my head. I still had a car, still had a job. But I could see that I was going down the tube again. And I knew my parents would try to save me, my mother in particular. My father was getting tired of my stuff, but he loved my mother unconditionally. And she loved me unconditionally. And I could see that they were going to have to save me again. I was doing it again. And I did something different that day that I had never done before. I said, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. I just couldn't take it any longer. And so I did. Those nine simple words saved my life. The God of my understanding reached down and removed the obsession to use drugs for me in that moment. I don't poke too many holes in that. I don't overanalyze it. I don't try to figure out why me, you know, I'm not worthy, all of that shit. I just stopped. The obsession to use drugs was removed from me in that moment. And I'm forever grateful for that. The irony of that is when the drugs are removed from the equation, you find out just how broken you really are. How they are truly your coping mechanism, how they are the way you deal with life on life's terms, and that I didn't know how to deal with life on life's terms without the use of drugs. I was clueless on how to live my life without using. But, you know, that was the miracle of that moment, you know, that the obsession to use drugs was gone. But then I realized that I had so many other obsessions and so many other manifestations, as I've come to understand, of my disease, of my addiction, that I had to work on. You know, thinking that drugs were my problem, you know, at some point in my life they had become my solution, but now they were just the obvious manifestation of my problem, right? I walked into my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting working on my fifth day clean, December 20th, 1998. Let me finish the other part of that story. December 14th, the obsession was lifted. December 15th, I went into work, told him I had a problem. He put me on a leave of absence. I went to see the doctor. He hooked me up with the outpatient treatment. I went home, and there was one blast left that I had left from the weekend. And I did it. I didn't throw it out. And this is why I emphasize the grace and mercy of the God of my understanding. Because I didn't know about Narcotics Anonymous at that point. And I did that last blast. And I woke up the morning of December 16th, 1998, clean for the first time since I had been 12. And I haven't chosen to do any more research. I picked up one white key tag. It took me 31 years to get that white key tag. But nonetheless, that's the only one I've ever picked up. I haven't chosen to do any more research. So that's been a blessing in my life, for sure. But, you know, in hindsight, I didn't realize it, but in that first moment, that moment of surrender and that moment of epiphany, I had worked the first three steps without even realizing it, right? I surrendered. I realized that I had a problem and I needed help, right? My first step. And I said, God, please help me. I can't do this anymore. So I had come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And then I turned my will and my life over to the care of that God of my understanding in that moment. And I found Narcotics Anonymous at the ultimate end of that, turning over that initial journey into 1, 2, 3, you know, and I didn't even know I had worked them. It wasn't until years, you know, it wasn't until a year or two later, after going through the steps, that I put two and two together, and I realized that the step process, had already manifested itself in my life, you know. And now over the years, I've been through the 12 steps 4 times end to end, and during my 5th transition through, I had gotten up to step 5, and then I relocated to South Carolina. My new sponsor has me on the maintenance steps, as they like to call them, because he's a firm believer, and if you work 10 every day, if you work 10, 11, and 12, 10 will point you to the areas of your life that you have to work on. And I think he's right. That's why he's my sponsor. I happen to agree with a lot of things he says to me. But so my journey into recovery began, you know, at that moment. And I went to, in the beginning, I went to both fellowships religiously, because I wanted to continue to ball with my friends. I wasn't willing to surrender completely. I, you know, because I love my friends. They weren't just my using buddies. They had been friends of mine for years. But as it turned out, that made my life unmanageable too. So I ended up stepping away from them. But I, for my first 10 months clean, I went to both AA and NA religiously. I made 11 meetings a week for my first 10 months clean. So I made a lot of meetings. And, you know, ironically, I never made 90 and 90 in that period of time. I don't know why, but at least not my first 90 days. Ultimately, I did, but my first 90 days, I did not make 90 and 90, although I made 211 meetings in 90 days. But that's a story for another day. So, but that's, you know, that's part of my journey. But I got involved with a sponsor. And that really, I want to share this with you. The first sponsor I had was an AA sponsor. He started taking me through the steps, and I realized I got through step 5 there, and I realized there's something missing here, man. This is way too fast. And it might have been the sponsor, I don't know. But I was just starting to understand through talking with NA members, you know, I started to explore why I entertained that other fellowship. And I realized because I was 43 years old when I got clean, there was a lot of men that age in that fellowship. And so I had kind of a built-in support group at my age, in my age bracket. So it was very comfortable for me there. But I realized that wasn't the message that I needed to recover with, that the message of Narcotics Anonymous was my true calling, because my problem wasn't alcohol. And they kept telling me that I needed to keep it in the bottle, and I needed to share about solid alcohol. And it's like, how am I practicing honesty in my first step if I'm lying about what I do? So I came to Narcotics Anonymous because I didn't have to modify my story. I didn't have to change anything. I could share about whatever I needed to share about in an NA meeting, and it was okay, right? I didn't have to wear a mask. I didn't have to hide my drug use, because alcohol is a drug, right? So you guys saved me from myself. You afforded me the opportunity to work an honest program of recovery. And I'm forever grateful for that, you know. And, you know, in this process, you know, of surrender, I mean, it's been quite a journey. You know, that first step, you know, we talk about, you know, one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles, right? And we go on to talk about three of these that are indispensable are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. With these, we're well on our way, right? And then we talk about things like impatience and intolerance, our defects, right? And, you know, I've just come to understand, it's my experience in the step process, that honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness resonate throughout all the steps, right? They resonate throughout the traditions too. But, you know, because that's really, when we talk about the ties that bind us together, it's not only that bind us together as individuals into a community of recovering addicts, but it's also what unites our steps, our traditions together. It's the same spiritual principles that are embodied in the steps that we apply in our personal lives are embodied in the traditions, so that we can apply them to the group and to our recovery as a fellowship. You know, so our spiritual principles are the ground that we walk on. You know, they are the life force of our program. You know, and if I choose, you know, I can remember hearing people in early recovery saying like things like acting out in defect and going, well, hey, I'm not on that step yet. You know, and it's like my sponsor, I remember my sponsor sharing with me, he goes, Tim, when we come into recovery and we're acting out in those behaviors, you know, when we're doing it in the beginning and we're unaware of the behavior, we're doing it in ignorance. And it's not that that makes it okay, but it's acceptable because you don't know any better. But once you become aware of the defect and you act out in it anyway, you're acting out in arrogance. And that always rang true with me. It's like if I'm aware of it and I'm doing it anyway, I'm living in disease, right? So, you know, I came in, you know, and to be perfectly honest, my first home group in recovery, you know, whatever keeps you here, right? But there was a tall brunette in that meeting and I fell in love with her or fell in lust with her. I didn't really understand what love was, but I fell in, and she kept me coming back, you know? And it was through that process that I stayed engaged with the fellowship. And as it turns out, she became one of my greatest supporters and one of my best friends in recovery. She had 6 years clean. That seemed like forever at that time when I got clean. It was like 6 years. Wow. You know, and my sponsor, who ultimately became my sponsor, had 12 years clean. It's like, wow. You know, I was in awe of these people, placing them on pedestals later, only to find that all I did was make the fall quicker, longer for them when my own expectations knocked them off of that pedestal. You know, but that was my shit, and it took a while to learn that stuff. But, you know, it was like I did a lot of things for the wrong reasons when I first got here, but it was a loving and caring fellowship that helped me get through that stuff. And I remember I got involved in service right away, sweeping up cigarette butts and cleaning ashtrays and vacuuming the floor because the meeting place that we had was carpeted, you know, and I really loved it. I really loved that meeting. It was a long, you know, at max we could fit 24 people in that meeting. If we were laying people on top of one another, we could get 30 in there. And but you walked into that room and you could feel the spirituality in that room. And I loved and embraced that room for years. But, you know, I got involved in that first step, my first time into the first step. And I remember looking at those questions and it was really easy to admit that I was an addict. I had 31 years of evidence of my addiction. Whether or not I accepted it at first is another story, but it was easy for me to admit it because I could see the obvious unmanageability of my life and I could admit my powerlessness. But it wasn't, but the acceptance came a little slower, you know, the acceptance and the surrender, you know, we were just talking about that earlier today about acceptance and surrender. Do they come together? They're like the chicken or the egg, right? Do I surrender and then I accept, or do I accept and then I surrender? It always seems to me to work better in my life when I accept something, I can surrender. So that seems to be the way it works for me. But however it works for you, that's up to you. But that acceptance and surrender came, and I was able to admit that I had really say it. Because, you know, that admittance is a head game, right? Admittance is using my logic. My brain is telling me, yeah, you got a drug problem. But acceptance is my heart. Like when I accept something for truly what it is, that's my heart talking. That's not my brain. You know, that's the amazing thing, you know, is that 18 inches from our head to our heart, that longest journey in recovery that we talk about. You know, it's not that. You know, it's not that we understand the spiritual principles, it's that we live them. It's not that we understand the steps, it's that we live them. It's a way of life. It's not something we do a couple hours a day. It's the way we live, right? You know, I remember somebody talking to me about integrity and saying that integrity is what you're doing the other 22 and a half hours when nobody's looking. You know, how you live in your life then, you know, because it's easy to recover for an hour and a half a day. So anyway, so I, as I was saying earlier, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness resonate throughout every step, right? If I don't approach every step with honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, I'm not going to reap the benefits of the step. Because if I don't work it honestly, I'm not going to get the results. If I'm not open-minded to the prospect of working the step, I'm not going to get the results. And if I'm not willing to apply the results in my life, why did I work the step in the first place, right? So honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness are always there. And I always have my sponsor and I talk about the steps being a journey to humility. I used to think it was like a journey to perfection, but he always reminds me it's not that. It's a journey to coming to understand who we truly are, right? But I always thought like humility started showing up around 6 and 7, 4, 5, 6, and 7, where that active change of attitudes and behaviors occurs. But in our step working guide, which I happen to love, it was when I first set around the steps was through the step working guide in 1998, well, 1999 officially. Right in the very first step, it talks about humility being a spiritual principle of the first step. And that humility comes into play when I surrender, when I admit that I am powerless, that I need help, when I recognize that I can't do this alone, and I say, please help me. That's the beginning, that first kernel of life that humility takes place in my recovery. That first moment that I surrender and say, I need help, I can't do this alone. And that's the beginning of the miracle for me. You know, the beginning of when that humility began in my life is when I began to grow and change in recovery. I truly became a Narcotics Anonymous member at that moment. I'm not sure if I was before that, but I definitely was then. You know, and I got into step two, and I'm a recovering Catholic. I know this isn't a religious program, but I am who I am. I'm a recovering Catholic, so I had this fixed idea of who the God of my understanding was. You know, fire and brimstone, all that good stuff. And pardon me, time to take a drink. And so, having that understanding of the God of my understanding, or I should say having that misunderstanding of the God of my understanding, I worked the first, I was actually step six where I ran into my first true difficulty because I wasn't utilizing the fellowship because I passed over the second step with a minimum of concern, right? And I had to go back because I was struggling with 6 and 7. I really was struggling with them. And I had to go back and revisit 2. And the second time through, I realized for me, for this addict, it wasn't about God, the deity, or God, the higher power. It was about the fellowship with Narcotics Anonymous. See, the God of my understanding had led me to NA. And I had to come to believe that the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous had worked for me. And I had to come to believe that the fellowship had my best interests at heart. And I had to come to believe that this process would work for me, right? That this whole thing was not just an exercise in futility. And in the process of coming to believe those things, I got faith and I got hope and I got trust. Along with all those other things, again, humility, because I was reaching out for help. So having that faith and that hope and that trust in my life really changed the whole dynamic of my recovery, right? Understanding that the fellowship was the tool that the God of my understanding presented to my life, you know, that I could recover one day at a time and that you guys would help me do that. So in that process, I turned my will and my life over to the care of the God of my understanding. At the same time, by doing that, I was turning my will and my life over to the care of my sponsor. I was turning the care of my will and my life over to the fellowship, over to my support group, over to my home group, over to Narcotics Anonymous, because the will of the God of my understanding for me was that I recover one day at a time and use this program for what it was. So that was another deeper level of surrender. Every step for me, again, humility, but every step is a deeper level of surrender. For me, because I have to surrender a little more of my ego and allow you guys into my life to help me change. You know, then we get into 4, 5, you know, we can stay clean a long time on 1, 2, 3, but active change of attitudes and behaviors happens in 4, 5, 6, and 7, right? We get into a fourth step where we start looking at patterns and how every woman I ever dated was the same woman, and every job I ever had was the same job, and every group of people I ever hung around with suited my purposes. They all facilitated my use of drugs. My jobs, the jobs that I picked, the women that I chose to get in relationships with, the social groups, Every one of those patterns in my life all revolved around my drug use, and I had to come to grips with that, and I had to get to the exact nature of that wrongs, right? And in a fifth step, of course, but through the process of working a fourth step, again, humility is always resonating in a fourth step, but perseverance and courage and integrity, be able to have the wherewithal to work through that. Because after 31 years of active addiction, my first fourth step was a tome. I mean, I literally filled two composition notebooks. One of them was my resentments, and the rest of the step was everything else, you know, because I had a lot of stuff to write about, a lot of perceived slights and damages, and, you know, and thank God for that first fourth step, because I cleared a lot of wreckage. I got to the exact nature, not to everything, but I got to the exact nature of many, many wrongs in that first, fourth, and fifth step, you know. But ultimately, why do we do a fourth step and a fifth step? But to uncover our defects of character, right? And at the core of that is self-obsession, self-centered fear, right? Because that's what my whole life was all about, was self-centered fear. I wasn't going to get what I want. I wasn't going to get what I need. I wasn't going to get what I was entitled to. I wasn't going to be loved. You guys were going to reject me. You weren't going to appreciate me for who I really am. You know, yet I never let you know who I really was anyway. So, you know, all of that being said, when I think back to, there's that reading on October 5th, ask for mercy, not justice. When I think of, I used to demand to get what I was entitled to. And in hindsight, if I really would have gotten what I was entitled to, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I'd be dead or in jail. All right. I wouldn't be living the life that I live today if I got what I was entitled to. I received mercy, not justice. So who am I to judge another human being? Who am I to stand there in judgment of someone else? You know, because I didn't receive judgment. I received mercy. The grace and mercy of a loving and caring God, and the grace and mercy of a loving and caring fellowship. So I have to be grateful for that, and I have to recognize that in my life, you know, through this step process, you know, because it's also for me, it's come to me to understand that it's the steps are about love and forgiveness, right? In the process of working 4, 5, 6, and 7 and doing an eighth step and a ninth step, we learn to love ourselves and forgive ourselves. And then in that process, we learn to love and forgive other people. You know, when we do that eighth step and, you know, I'm not going to dwell on 6 and 7 a lot because most of you know that self-centered fear, where that, you know, where that takes us, you know, all the other defects of character, whether it be gluttony or lust or greed or any other, you know, cardinal sins, whatever you want to call them. But, you know, everything branches off of that self-centered fear. Am I going to get what I need? You know, and so I start placing spiritual principles in their place, like instead of intolerance, tolerance. Instead of impatience, patience, right? And it, I have to laugh, you know, I remember the first time I heard it, that God has a sense of humor. I truly believe it because, and you, what's the other phrase? You got to watch what you pray for, because every time I would pray for patience and God would put me in situations where I had to practice patience, right? I would pray for moderation and he would place me in situations where I had to practice moderation, you know? So, you know, that's the sense of humor that the God of my understanding has. So I was forever becoming entirely ready and forever humbly asking for them to be removed. Certain defects are very comfortable, right? I remember my good friend Al R, who was clean 19 years when I got clean, or might have been almost 20 when I got clean, but I asked him about 6 and 7, and he told me that 6 is the thought that rolls through my head, right? The defect is that bright idea that I get, and the shortcoming is the action that follows that thought, you know? So that's how I began to recognize my defects. It's like when I would think about stealing, I would think about shoplifting. Well, that's the defect, right? But the actual shortcoming is put my hand down and stick it in my pocket, picking that item up and putting it in my pocket. So that was my understanding of 6 and 7, but 8, 9, and 10 really go together with me, because 8 and 9 are clearing the wreckage of my past, and 10 is clearing the wreckage of my present, right? or in, I guess to say it better, to, so that make sure that no wreckage of my present accumulates, because when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it, right? But nine, we were talking about this earlier today, nine is all about changing the attitudes and behaviors, right? Changing the action, making an amend for the harm, and then changing the action associated with the amends. Because if I don't change the action, then what amends have I made? Like if I continue, if I've robbed you and I make amends and make restitution and all of that and you forgive me, and then I go out and I rob somebody else, what amends have I made? The behavior is still there. So, because the amends are about me. It's about me taking ownership of who I am and what I've done and moving on with my life and becoming the best version of myself, right? At least that's my interpretation of it anyway. And 10 is just making sure that I don't screw up anymore. You know, well, not that I don't screw up anymore, but that I own my stuff. And I just try to be the best person I can be today. 11 culminates the journey that began in 3 when I turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And everything comes bears fruit in 11. You know, I've always imagined that wreckage of my past and a wreckage of my present as debris on the floor, right? So for instance, consider your kitchen has a swinging door on it. Well, the door into the living room always swings freely because there's no clutter on the floor, right? And that's when I pray, God always hears, the God of my understanding always hears my prayer, all right? Because that door always swings freely to God. But if there's wreckage of my past clutter on the floor, that door can't swing freely in my direction. Because I'm still up in my head. I'm still caught up in resentment, anger, and fear. I'm still living in disease. I haven't surrendered that stuff, right? Triangle of self-obsession, which I'll touch on briefly. But so if I have that wreckage clear, the door swings freely. Now, I don't hear booming voices and see burning bushes, at least not since I stopped doing acid. But the thing about it is where the God of my understanding speaks to me is sometimes it's simply in meditation. I have this incredible sense of peace that comes over me that just lets me know that everything's going to be okay, right? But most times when I'm going through something, I walk into an NA meeting and I will hear somebody share that they're going through the same thing that I'm going through, which is those famous two words, me too, or somebody will share a solution that they have found for the exact same dilemma. So in one fell swoop, I either hear that I'm not alone and that I'm not going through this, that somebody's walking this path of pain with me or difficulty and somebody else has gone through it, or somebody else has a solution and it may work for me. So that's how the God of my understanding speaks to me, is through you guys. That's the miracle of this process, the therapeutic value of one addict helping another. So I got 2 minutes left and I just want to share about the triangle of self-obsession, right? Living in resentment, reliving past moments over and over and over again, and the unmanageability they cause, and the anger and the frustration that they always cause, and then anger in the present because life isn't treating me the way I think it should be treating me, and fear of the future because, oh God, am I going to be able to do this? Am I going to be able to live this life? Am I going to have enough money? Blah, 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 you know? Then the solution to that, right? Acceptance, love, and faith. You know, I want to talk about acceptance first. Accepting who I was and my past. I don't have to like it. Acceptance isn't about liking. It's just about accepting because it is what it is. I have to accept my past for what it was because it is what it was. But it's not who I am today. So I accept who I was so I can become who I am. And then I'm going to jump to faith for a second. And the faith of the future is not that I'm going to get everything I want and everything I need. It's that as a direct result of the step process and the trust and the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous and the loving, caring God, I have faith that no matter what happens, no matter what life on life's terms places in my path, I will ultimately be okay. I will be okay. And that's my faith. And that faith, I'm not fearless. That faith gives me the strength to walk through my fear. And that's the gift, right? Because we grow through what we go through. It's only through getting to the other side of situations and circumstances in our lives that present themselves. I mean, if I never had an obstacle to grow through, where would my recovery be? You know, because I must be taking the easier, softer way if I don't have any problems in my life at all. You know, life doesn't happen to me. Life just happens. It's how I deal with it that gets me through to the other side. And that's what faith does for me. It gets me through to the other side. It gives me the courage and perseverance and the fortitude, another spiritual principle, to get through. You know, and then to come back to the moment, to the now, we can only recover in the now, right? In this moment, just for today. That's why it's a Just for Today program. The God of my understanding and the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous can't meet me in yesterday. I can't recover there. That's where my disease lives. Sometimes I have to go back there to check on some stuff and to dig out some information. But if I'm living there, I'm living in disease. And Narcotics Anonymous and the God of my understanding can't help me in the future because it's not here yet. And if I'm living there, I'm living in disease. But if I'm living in this moment, if I'm living in the here and now, which is the name of my home group here in South Carolina, the here and now, if I'm living in this moment, I have all the tools available to me to recover one moment at a time, one minute at a time, whatever it takes. This is where the God of my understanding and you guys can help me live. And as long as I stay here, everything else will work out because it's in this moment that the miracle happens. It's only in this moment that I can recover. And I'll touch one more thing on the triangle of self-obsession. The last sentence in the triangle of self-obsession is, we must grow up or die. All right? So I die when I live in disease. I die when I live in active addiction. I die when I entertain my addiction, right? That's how I die. And if I use again, the one true fear that I have is that I would pick up again and not physically die, that I would live on in the misery that active addiction provides for me. All right. I grow here by working the steps and changing who and what I am on a daily basis for as long as that takes. It's our Living Clean book tells us that living clean, the journey continues. It doesn't say living clean, we've arrived. It says the journey continues. And that's what this is. It's a daily reprieve from the disease of addiction. Every day, first words out of my mouth, 99.9% of the time, is thank you. Thank you for waking me up. Thanking you. Thank you for an opportunity for another day clean. And then my prayer every day is, God, please meet me where I will need you the most and place me where you need me to be. Because that's the journey. Right? Just doing God's will for me, because it talks about in step 11 that my will and God's will ultimately align, and we begin to live in God's will for us because of the spiritual principles that are embodied in this program. I'm not always living in God's will. I often take Tim's will back, but as long as I don't stay in Tim's will for too long, my life usually improves. Steve and the group, I just want to thank you guys for putting up with me for 45 minutes. I can't believe I spoke for this long, but I love you very much. Have a glorious day today. And if nobody told you they love you, I do. And you're hanging around with the wrong people. Namaste.